Well, Richard Dawkins, one of the world's most brilliant and famous scientists and philosophers. His first book, The Selfish Gene, became an immediate international bestseller, and like The Blind Watchmaker, only one other of his books, it was translated into all the major languages. Well, there's a list of awards that is as long as my arm. He's often described as a genius, which is must be vastly intimidating. His new book, hugely controversial, hugely exciting, anti-religion polemic called The God Delusion. It's published by Bentham. I would say to you, if you only read one more book in your lifetime, read this one. Welcome, Richard Dawkins. Let me say that again, because there was a blip on the line. Welcome, Richard Dawkins.
Thank you very much.
Now, just a little bit of background, if I may, before I get to the God Delusion. You started out as an ethologist. Can you tell us what an ethologist is? You know, we have a wonderful audience here in South Africa, particularly for this program, which can range from university professors to petrol pump attendants to whatever. So I like everybody to sort of come into the context and find out, you know, exactly what we're talking about and doing. So an ethologist.
An ethologist is a scientific student of animal behavior.
Okay. So you explore and explain the nature of animal behavior.
Yes, animal behavior from a biological point of view, which normally means from an evolutionary point of view.
Okay.
It is a subject founded by Konrad Lorenz and Nico Tinbergen.
Oh, in the ring, the geese and the
ring.
That's right. Now, then you, Richard Dawkins, the ethologist, sort of fairly rapidly mutated into an evolutionary biologist. Now, what's the difference?
Well, it's not that much. I mean, evolution is the explanation for all of life, and that includes, of course, animal behavior. So it was just really a fairly small step from being an ethologist to being an evolutionist.
And the ethology of the gene?
I'm not sure that's a phrase that one should really use. I know I've seen it written down somewhere. It's quite a vivid phrase, quite a poetic phrase.
But meaningless.
It's quite a hard phrase to defend, really. I suppose what it means is that in my first book, The Selfish Gene, I concentrated upon the gene as the level of life at which natural selection, that's Darwin's process of natural selection, really acts. So that everything that an animal does, everything that an animal is, could be said to be for the good of its genes.
Okay. Really a sort of random question, but when you hear yourself described as a genius, what do you think?
I think that is very flattering and a gross exaggeration. I'm not a genius.
How do you know?
Well, because I know one or two people who are, and they're very different.
Okay.
But it's very kind of you to use the word.
Okay. Well, there you go. Now, your new book, The God Delusion, you say right at the outset, and I quote, "I shall not go out of my way to offend, nor shall I don kid gloves to handle religion any more gently than I would handle anything else." And you come up with this extraordinary, evocative phrase, the privileging of religion. Can you talk us through that, Richard?
Yes. I think nobody wants to offend anybody, but I do think that our society has got used to the idea that religion is somehow particularly vulnerable to offence and should be particularly immune to it. If you disagree with somebody's politics, then you can have a robust argument with them and you can differ and you can respect each other, but nevertheless you disagree. But if you disagree with somebody's religion, then people tend to regard that as taboo. You're not allowed to offend somebody's religion. It's somehow additionally hurtful. I think that's nonsense. I think that religious people should have to defend their beliefs just as strongly as we defend our political beliefs or our economic beliefs.
And it seems to be getting more and more, this privileging of religion.
Well, I think that may be so. I don't know how it is in South Africa, but I know that in America it is, and I get the feeling that in large parts of Africa, religion is really striding away. In parts of America and parts of Africa, I think, are becoming religious maniacs.
Now, why the God delusion? Why do you use the word delusion?
Well, a delusion is a false belief which catches hold of somebody, particularly when it catches hold of lots of people. And I think that's what religion is. There's absolutely no evidence that there's any kind of God, any more than there's any evidence for fairies or spirits or ghosts or flying spaghetti monsters. So I think it is a delusion. And because it's so widely held, just about everybody in the world hold this delusion, not everybody, but I mean a very substantial proportion of people do. I think it's worthy of the title of mass delusion.
But how did it then all start?
Well, I think it's very old, obviously. Every culture, every anthropologist tell us that every culture in the world has some form of religion. I think it probably is a natural predisposition that all humans have, rather like they have a natural predisposition to sexual lust. I think there's a kind of lust for gods which comes from our historic and evolutionary past. That, of course, doesn't make it true, but I think it is rather basic to human nature.
Of course, there's a so-called scientific theory, you know, about being hardwired for God, that humankind is hardwired for God.
Well, I think you have to be careful what that means. You could say that the human brain is hardwired for various psychological predispositions which might lead you to God. For example, a predisposition to obey authority, to be obedient, to follow leaders. Various things like that could very well be hardwired and could, under the right circumstances, lead to religion.
But then, you know, and I'm being devil's advocate, unintentional pun.
Before you go on, I don't know whether your engineers can turn the sound up a bit. Your voice is extremely quiet here.
Okay, I'll boom a bit more. Is that better?
Okay. I don't think it's your fault. I think maybe it's something technical.
Okay, is that better?
Yes, it is.
Okay. Just to play devil's advocate, unintentional pun, for a moment, if we are predisposed to religion, surely then there would be an argument that says, well, there must be some kind of supernatural power or God.
Oh, no, I don't think that follows at all. You can be predisposed to a psychological propensity, but that doesn't mean that it's really true. People have long been predisposed to believe in ghosts and been predisposed to believe in life after death, all sorts of things, probably because of wishful thinking. But just because you want to believe something, that doesn't constitute evidence that it's true.
Now, the God hypothesis you talk about in the book, can you sort of talk us through that?
Well, there are various versions of the God hypothesis. Some scientists use the word God in a pretty abstract way. They don't really mean anything personal. They sort of mean some kind of deeply mysterious thing at the base of the universe. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about a hypothesis that there is an intelligent being, a creator, somebody who listens to your prayers and forgives your sins and reads your thoughts, and somebody that you can have an actual relationship with, a personal God, the sort of personal God that Einstein did not believe in. So the God hypothesis is that the universe was started, invented, created by a personal being who is still around and who has the direct interest in human affairs and communicates with humans via prayer.
And to you, that's rubbish.
Well, there's certainly no evidence for it, and I think that it's such a complicated idea that if there is no evidence for it, then the more prudent thing for us to do is to disbelieve it. I think it is rubbish, yes.
This will be the time to bring in, because you talk about Bertrand Russell and his celestial teapot, and I thought that was a very good kind of analogy.
Bertrand Russell, the great philosopher, invented his celestial teapot to answer the point that people often put to him, shouldn't you really be an agnostic? Because after all, you can't disprove the existence of God. And Russell said, well, no, you can't disprove the existence of God, but then there are a million things you can't disprove, and that doesn't constitute a reason for believing in them. Suppose, he said, that I were to tell you that there's a teapot in orbit around the sun between the orbits of Earth and Mars. It's too small to be seen by our largest telescopes, so you can't disprove it. But just because you can't disprove the existence of the celestial teapot, that does not mean that there's any reason to believe it. And most people, indeed everybody in the world, I think, would say, I positively do not believe that there is a teapot in orbit around the sun. So we are atheists, or we are a teapotist. And Russell's point was that there is no more reason to believe in God than there is to believe that there's a China teapot in orbit around the sun.
Now, you deal in the book very firmly and very lucidly and very persuasively, I may say, with the arguments for God's existence. Can we just run through just some of those?
Yes. Well, St. Thomas Aquinas set them out long ago. Some of them were things like there has to be a first cause for everything. And that, in a way, invokes the idea of an infinite regress. That means that everything has to have a cause. And so you could go back and back and back and back to the origin of everything. The origin of everything had to have a cause. The problem with that argument is that you don't actually explain anything by suddenly inventing a God. To say that the first cause of everything was God immediately invites the question, well, then who caused God, or what caused God? So you haven't actually answered the question. Another of Aquinas' major arguments was the argument from design. And that's, I suppose, the most popular one today.
Mm-hmm.
The world is full of beautiful and elegant things, especially living things. Living things swim and walk and fly and dig, have wings, have eyes, have legs, have all sorts of things that look as though they've been designed. And we are used to saying, well, if something is designed, obviously there must be a designer. And that's what Thomas Aquinas said. But the problem with that is that we now know from Darwin that there's a much better theory, a much better explanation for where this apparent design of living things came from. It came from evolution by natural selection. And the beauty of evolution is that it explains how complicated, which means improbable, things came into existence by gradual degrees, step by step, from simple beginnings. And it's much easier to explain how a simple thing comes into existence than a complex thing. So we start off by postulating a simple beginning to all of life. And then we say over millions, billions of years, by gradual, slow, step-by-step degrees, under Darwin's idea of natural selection, the simple beginnings became gradually more complicated, more elegant, more beautiful, and more and more carrying the illusion of design, until today we have eyes and hearts and kidneys and things which look overwhelmingly as though they've been designed. But they've all been produced by this process of gradual, incremental, step-by-step evolution. Now that's a really brilliant explanation, because it starts with something simple, which is easy to understand, and it works up by slow, explicable degrees to something complicated and improbable, like an eye or a heart.
Which begs the question, of course, where did the something simple come from?
Well, that is still a question, but notice that it's a much, much smaller question than where did the complicated things come from. If we had to say that complicated things like eyes and hearts suddenly sprang into existence, we really would be in trouble. But we don't have to say that anymore because of Darwin. All we have to say because of Darwin is that something very simple came into existence, something molecular came into existence. And that's a whole lot easier to explain than that something complicated like an eye came into existence. Nobody actually knows how life began 4 billion years ago. We know roughly the kind of process it must have been, but we don't know precisely how it came about. Scientists are working on it. They'll probably solve it soon.
Now, I'm going to ask you a very sort of simplistic question. Here, you know, just 40 kilometres from the downtown Johannesburg, we have the cradle of humankind, Marapeng, yeah, which has just been opened this year. It's a wonderful place to visit. But one of the questions, apparently, that is asked, particularly by school children, perhaps by people who haven't done a lot of reading or whatever, one of the most common questions, well, I was asked by one of the guides there to ask you, what do you say to people who don't believe we descended from monkeys or ascended from monkeys?
They're just wrong. what they need to do is to look at the evidence. The evidence is quite simply overwhelming. Not just the fossil evidence, although that is very persuasive, but even more persuasive than that is the DNA evidence. If you look at the DNA of any animal or plant, you'll find that it has essentially the same genetic code. The genetic code is a long list of letters. It's just like a written text, a hugely long written text with always the same kinds of letters. And that means that you can compare the written text of a human, a monkey, a rabbit, a springbok, any animal you like or any plant you like. And you can count up the number of similarities and the number of differences. And what you find is that it all falls into a perfect family tree. Well, it's a tree that is most easily interpreted as a family tree. So closer cousins like humans and chimpanzees, which are not monkeys, they're apes, close cousins like humans and chimpanzees have very, very similar DNA indeed. And then if you look at monkeys, they're a bit more distant. They have somewhat similar DNA to both chimps and humans, equally close, by the way, to chimps and humans. They're not any closer to chimps than they are to humans. So chimps and humans are our very close cousins. Monkeys are slightly more distant cousins. Rabbits are slightly more distant cousins again, and so on. And the more distant the cousins, the more different the DNA is. And you can look at the entire tree of life, and it really does form a tree, and it shows exactly what you'd expect if it is a family tree. Not only the DNA that's useful, but also lots and lots of other DNA which is doing nothing, which is a kind of vestige of old DNA that's not doing anything anymore. Rather like if you look at a computer disk, you find lots of old copies of files that you think you've deleted that are actually kind of knocking around in discarded copies on your hard disk. Exactly the same thing goes on in the genome. So the human DNA or monkey DNA all has old DNA on it, which is left over from the ancestral past. The world of life is simply full of such facts, which are beautifully explained on the assumption that we've all evolved and cannot be explained on any other assumption except that God is deliberately trying to trick us into thinking that evolution happened. Do you want to believe in a God who would play such tricks?
SMS is coming in, a lot of them mentioning consciousness. What about consciousness, whatever that is?
Consciousness is one of the most bewildering and difficult problems facing us at present. I don't think anybody really understands consciousness. I don't think any scientist understands consciousness, and I'm quite certain that no theologian understands consciousness either. It's a great mystery. Maybe one day we'll solve it. I hope so.
Now, morality. You deal with morality and you deal with the roots of morality, and it was something I was discussing with an earlier guest, Jacques Rousseau from the Brights here in Cape Town, and I asked him, don't we need God to be good? A question you pose in your book, The God Delusion. Do we need God to be good?
Well, we clearly don't, because if you actually ask yourself what is good and what is bad, everybody nowadays agrees that slavery is bad. But you won't find slavery condemned in the Bible. The things that we now think are good, like giving rights to women, giving rights to all races, all those sorts of things, they're not in the Bible. A few of the good things that we believe in today are in the Bible. But you have to pick and choose which verses of the Bible you believe and which you don't. There are lots and lots of verses in the Bible that are quite simply horrible, like you have to stone people to death if they break the Sabbath or if they worship a graven image. So nowadays we all discard those verses of the Bible, but we like the verses like Jesus' Sermon on the Mount, for example. So we can go through the Bible picking and choosing, cherry-picking the verses that we like and throwing away the verses that we don't like. Now, by what criterion do we choose the good verses and throw out the bad verses? Whatever that criterion is something quite complicated. It's something that we all have. All of us in today's world have a picture of morality and ethics, what's right and wrong, which is very different from the biblical picture, but we pretty much share it. We all agree in the rights of everybody. We all agree that we don't have slavery. We agree with the rights of women. We agree with equality of races, all that kind of thing. We agree about that whether we are religious or not. And those people who want to justify their morality by referring to the Bible will look at the Bible and cherry-pick those verses of the Bible that fit in with that consensus which we all share, whether we're religious or not. And they'll throw out those verses that we don't share, whether we're religious or not. So it's quite manifest that, as a matter of fact, we don't use religion to determine what's right or wrong. We use something else. I'm not quite sure where that something else comes from. It'll be some sort of synthesis of law, parliamentary debate, journalism, books, dinner party conversations, all sorts of things like that contribute to a gradually shifting zeitgeist of morality, which changes over the decades. I mean, things are very different now from what they were 50 years ago in terms of morality, as people in South Africa know only too well. Whatever it is that is changing, it's changing in spite of religion, not because of religion. And the shifting morals are available to all of us, whether we are religious or not.
I'm talking to Professor Richard Dawkins about his new book, published by Bantam, called The God Delusion. Stay with us. We're going to take a commercial break, and then we'll be back.
If quality is a deciding factor in your life, opt for a Carl Greaves professional indemnity policy. As a Lloyd's cover holder, we are able to offer a choice of selected quotations specifically designed to fit your professional and industrial needs. Insure against errors and omissions with Carl Greaves Professional Indemnity. Call 948-0630. Carl Greaves Brokers, your specialist in professional indemnity, an authorized financial services provider. 567.
The key. It opens your car. Padlocks. The freezer. And of course, your house. But Remax knows a key is only as valuable as whatever it unlocks. And without that, a key is simply a piece of metal. Which is why at Remax, we give you more than just a key. We give you a home. Remax. Outstanding agents. Outstanding results.
Hi, I'm Alex J, inviting you to dance the night away in the name of charity. It's the second annual Winter Ball of the South African Guide Dogs Association for the Blind. Whimsical is the theme of the night, and with Saga's cuddly puppies, Edith Venter's glamour, and me as your host, well, the experience is going to be out of this world. This magical event is being held at the Cape Town International Convention Centre on Saturday, the 21st of October. To reserve your tickets, call 674-7395.
With the widest range of DVD titles at every Look and Listen store, you can find exactly what you're looking for, what you haven't seen in ages, what your best friend told you to look out for, the one you heard about on radio, that film that got the bad review, the one you missed on cinema, the one that wasn't released in cinema, the sequel you didn't know about, the original Japanese version, the entire collection, the limited edition box set with deleted scenes and commentary, even the film with that guy that does that thing all the time. And if we don't have it, we'll find it. Look and Listen. For the fans.
Get the vision for a brighter future. All this week, 567 Cape Talk and Muller's Optometrists are helping Cape Town see for free. Visit capetalk.co.za to stretch your vision, cite the answer, and win your share of 5,000 Rand in Muller's vouchers. Plus, simply by entering, you can help others see for free. This National Eye Care Awareness Week, Muller's will be donating free eye exams, spectacles, and cataract operations to various charities. Muller's Optometrists, caring for Cape Town's eyes for over a century. Let them care for yours. Enter now on capetalk.co.za.
Yo,
You're listening to Believe It or Not with Kate Stevenson
on 567
Cape Talk.
Cape Town's number one news and information station.
And on the line from the UK, Professor Richard Dawkins, author of The God Delusion, destined to become an instant classic, I think. I'm sorry about the heavy breathing. Some of you are complaining about heavy breathing, but Prof. Dawkins was having trouble hearing me, so I was sort of coming closer to the mic, but I'll make a plan so you don't get the heavy breathing bit. We were talking there before the break about the Bible, and I'm going to quote what you say about the Bible. A chaotically cobbled together anthology of disjointed documents, composed, revised, translated, distorted, and improved by hundreds of anonymous authors, editors, and copyists unknown to us. My question to you, and a question I'm sure listeners would like me to ask, is why then has the Bible endured?
No reason why a work of fiction shouldn't endure. I mean, the Bible is probably not total fiction, but plenty of works of fiction do endure. So the fact that something endures is no guarantee that it's true. I mean, Hans Andersen's fairy tales endure, but none of them are true. So I don't think the fact that it's endured is any, that bears one way or the other on whether it's true.
Okay. Now, what's wrong with religion? Got like a few days to answer.
Yes, I mean, nothing is wrong with a lot of people's religion. I mean, for many people it's perfectly harmless and doesn't do any damage to other people. I think it's a bit of a shame if you go through life labouring under a misconception of what the world and the universe are all about, why you're here, etc. But perhaps if that's what you like, I think it's a disappointing thing. I think I would like to show people that there is a better way, that it's more exciting to understand the real nature of life and the universe. But of course, although the vast majority of people who are religious don't do any harm, there is a minority who do a great deal of harm. Suicide bombers, people who fly planes into New York skyscrapers, people who conduct wars against religious enemies. A very large number of the killings in our world today are motivated by religion. It's only the extremists. But I do think there is a sense in which decent, moderate religion makes the world safe for extremism, in the sense that it teaches children that faith, which means belief without evidence, is a virtue. Now, if you're brought up to believe that it's right to say, I just believe this, I don't have to give any reasons, I know it's true because I know it's true because I know it's true, no evidence is given, if you're brought up to believe that that kind of faith is a virtue, then I think it's rather a small step from there to saying, well, I'm so confident that this is what my God wants me to do, I'm so confident that if I kill this person or if I die a martyr's death, I'll go straight to paradise. That, I think, is a recipe which, in the hands of even a minority of extremists, is very dangerous. And so I would like to discourage the habit of teaching children that faith is a virtue.
And in fact, you talk about child abuse, not in the way that one would ordinarily talk about child abuse, but you talk about children being labelled as a Catholic child, a Muslim child. In fact, you talk about a photograph you saw in a newspaper at Christmas that was sort of lauding the virtues of intercultural faith, because it had a nativity scene, and I forget the actual details, but Mary was played by a child of one faith, Joseph was played by a child of another faith, and the newspaper was more or less saying, isn't this wonderful?
That's right. It was a nativity play, as you say. It was actually the Three Wise Men.
The Three Wise Men, that's
right. One of the Three Wise Men was played by, I think it was Shadbreed, a Sikh. Another one was played by Musharraf, a Muslim, and a third was played by Adele, a Christian, all aged four. Now, my point is that four is much too young to know what you believe about the universe and humanity and morality. You cannot be a Sikh or a Muslim or a Christian if you're only four. What you can be is a child of Sikh parents or a child of Muslim parents or a child of Christian parents. That is, in truth, or that those children were, and I think it's a form of mental child abuse to tie a label around the child's neck and say, this is a Christian child, or this is a Muslim child. There is no such thing as a Christian child of four. There is only a child of Christian parents. You should no more talk about a Christian child than you would talk about a socialist child, or a Marxist child, or a conservative child, or a Keynesian child, or a monetarist child. Nobody would do that. You wouldn't talk about an atheist child, or you certainly shouldn't, or an agnostic child. Why then do we turn a blind eye when people, well, more than a blind eye, we actually approve when people tie a label around a child and say, this is a Catholic child, this is a Protestant child, or this is a Muslim child? I think that is child abuse.
What should parents do then? Let's take a hypothetical case of a Christian couple, devoted Christians. How would they raise their children? What would you suggest then?
I think ideally what they would do is to tell the child that there is this thing called religion, and there are people in the world who believe in Allah and Muhammad as his prophet. There are people in the world who believe in Buddha. There are Hindus who believe in lots and lots of gods. There are Protestants who believe this, there are Catholics who believe that. We, your mother and I, believe so-and-so. When you grow up, you'll be able to decide what you want to believe. Now, that may sound ridiculously idealistic, but I think that's actually the only decent thing to do.
Yeah, well, it certainly seems to make sense. Now, we're jumping around all over the place here, but atheists are often accused of, you know, having no joy, or that they can't understand the mystery of life, or there's no ecstasy, or and so on and so on and so on. Atheism can be very life-affirming, in your view. Is very life-affirming.
I mean, I have the most marvellous life. I've written a book called Unweaving the Rainbow, which is about the sort of atheist poetry. It's about the atheist view of life from a poetic point of view, and I talk about other poetry. I talk about the wonder of life, the wonder of science, how beautiful it is to be alive, how it's even more beautiful, and how you savor life even more because you know it's the only life you're ever going to get, rather than feeling that the present life is a kind of messing around while you wait for the next world. There is not going to be a next world, so make the most of this one. Enjoy it, revel in it, try to do good to other people in this world, make the most of this world, because there's never going to be another one. That's what I call life-affirming.
We had an SMS earlier on when we were talking to the Brights from Mary, who said, and this is something you deal with in the book, so it was very timeous what she actually wrote. She said that she can't be a free thinker because she was born and brought up a very staunch Catholic, and hell is part of the equation. How can she be free-thinking if she can't get rid of hell?
Yes, it's a big problem. I was talking a moment ago about child abuse, and telling children about hell is a flagrant piece of child abuse. It is absolutely immoral to tell children horror stories about things that are going to happen to them after they are dead. I received a letter from an American woman in her 40s who said that when she was 7, she suffered two kinds of child abuse. The first was that her priest fondled her sexually in his car. The second was that a little friend of hers, also 7, died and went to hell because she was a Protestant. My correspondent had been brought up Catholic. And she'd been told, presumably by the same priest, anyway, by her parents as well, that Protestants go to hell and Catholics go to heaven. Now, she said that the sexual abuse by the priest was trivial. She got over it in no time. But the abuse of being told that her little friend had gone to hell because she was a Protestant, she didn't get over for years. Now, that really is mental child abuse. Just because it wasn't physical, it doesn't mean it's any worse. I think that your correspondent, who is afraid of giving up being a Catholic because she was brainwashed as a child into believing in hell, I have every sympathy. Childhood brainwashing is immensely powerful, and I'm actually rather sorry that there is no hell for the people who brainwashed her to go to. However, unfortunately, they're going to just die like everybody else. But I would urge your correspondent to think again. I hope she'll read my book, and I hope she'll manage to rid herself of this horrible legacy of childhood brainwashing.
Lots of SMSs coming in too, Richard, about the soul. Do we have a soul? Is soul part of your thesis?
Well, we have a brain, and it's a very powerful brain, and it creates consciousness, and we all know internally that we have consciousness. Some people would regard that consciousness as a soul. Obviously, in that sense, we have one. However, if by soul you mean something that survives death, I think there's no evidence that we do, and I think it's very, very unlikely, because all the evidence suggests that our consciousness is a manifestation of the activity of our brain, and of course when we die, our brain rots, and so there's nothing left in which to produce the consciousness. So no, I'd be very, very, very surprised if there's any sort of soul that survives there.
Another question coming through that you deal with in your book, and one I know you've been asked hundreds of times, what about Hitler and Stalin? Weren't they atheists?
Well, Stalin certainly was an atheist. Hitler actually probably wasn't. Hitler started out a Roman Catholic, and he went on claiming to be a Roman Catholic all his life. If I may, I'd just like to read a little bit of a speech from Hitler. I've just got to find it in the book, if you don't mind.
No, not at all. It is something, you know, that one always hears quoted.
Indeed, it's a very common,
yeah.
It's a very common thing. Right, this is a speech by Adolf Hitler in 1922. My feeling as a Christian points me to my Lord and Saviour as a fighter. It points me to the man who once in loneliness, surrounded by a few followers, recognised these Jews for what they were, and summoned men to fight against them, and who, God's truth, was greatest not as a sufferer, but as a fighter. In boundless love as a Christian and as a man, I read through the passage which tells us how the Lord at last rose in his might and seized the scourge to drive out of the temple the brood of vipers and adders. How terrific was his fight for the world against the Jewish poison. Today, after 2,000 years, with deepest emotion, I recognize more profoundly than ever before the fact that it was for this that he had to shed his blood upon the cross. That was Adolf Hitler in 1922, and he went on maintaining that he was a Christian right up to near the end of his life.
And of course the logic is faulty. If we say that, for example, Stalin is an atheist, Stalin did bad things, therefore all atheists do bad things.
Of course, I mean that's absolutely rotten logic. There are some very bad atheists, there are some very bad Christians, there are some very good atheists and some very good Christians. The interesting question is whether atheism or religion tends to make you good or tends to make you bad, and I'm not sure that there's very much evidence for that one way or the other. I suspect there's much more variation between individuals than could be caused by religion. I did, however, mention earlier some reasons why having a sort of blind religious faith could make you do bad things.
And leading on from the sort of Hitler and Stalin fallacy, you talk about, and it's in the light of abortion, the great Beethoven fallacy. That's another one that it's an old chestnut that.
Abortion, of course, is a very hot potato at the moment, especially in America. I don't know whether it is in South Africa.
No, abortion is legal here.
It's legal, yes. Mm. Well, one of the things that the anti-abortionists say is something like this. It's a sort of hypothetical story. It says, imagine a doctor talking to another doctor, and one doctor says to the other, this mother has had 7 children already. They've all died. Some of them were blind. Some of them were deaf. Some of them had syphilis. There's a sort of great catalogue of terrible things. She's now pregnant again. Would you recommend an abortion? In that case... In that case, you would have murdered Beethoven. Excuse me. In that case, you would have murdered Beethoven. I've just got to have a drink of water. sorry.
Okay, no problem. Because this is, you know, this is a chestnut, an old chestnut that comes up all the time. The great Beethoven fallacy.
Hello, sorry.
Yes, no, no problem.
Now, in the first place, Beethoven was not the eighth child. He was actually the eldest of his family, so the story is a complete lie in any case. But even if it wasn't a lie, it's the most extraordinary fallacy, because unless you believe that having syphilis and deafness and blindness and things is positively more likely to make a musical genius, you are depriving the world of a potential Beethoven every time you refrain from an act of sexual intercourse. The argument that says don't perform an abortion because it might be Beethoven that you're aborting could equally well be used to say don't refrain from raping that woman, because if you do rape her, you might just produce a Beethoven. It's a total nonsense of an argument, but it's very typical of the kind of argument that's used by anti-abortionists.
And then you go on to talking about how moderation in faith fosters fanaticism. That seems almost a contradiction in terms.
Well, yes, I mean, I kind of dealt with that already when I suggested that moderation makes the world safe for fanatics by fostering the idea that faith is a virtue. That's all that I really meant, that if you teach people that faith is a virtue, that means that you don't have to justify your belief. You only have to say, that's part of my faith. You can't ask me any more questions. I don't have to answer them. It's just faith, which is true for religion, but is not true for anything else. Nobody would say, oh, I just believe in monetarist economics and I don't have to justify it, or I just believe in Keynesian economics, I just don't have to justify it. On the contrary, people say, well, yeah, no, you must justify it. You must tell me why. In the case of religion, we are taught from childhood onwards that faith is a virtue. You don't have to justify it. It's never questioned. It's a private matter, and you are allowed to do anything you like as long as it's in the name of faith. I've always been a bit surprised, actually, that in the apartheid time, the advocates of apartheid didn't simply say, oh, it's part of our faith that the races should be separate. And I suspect that a lot of moderate opinion would have come.
Oops. We lost Prof. Dawkins. I was about to interrupt him and say, the Bible was used as a basis for some of the tenets of apartheid. We'll get Prof. Dawkins back. In the meantime, we'll take a break.
John Nathan on 567 Cape Talk.
John and Claremont, you have some experience in Australia with these HOVs?
Kind of, it's an ethical part of kind of road life and road behaviour. And it's actually quite commonplace to, if you were to drive from one of the eastern suburbs towards the centre of the city, that you'd have they call them T2 or T3 lanes, where you have two or three passengers with you, and that you're only allowed to drive in those lanes, obviously, if you have the number of passengers.
567 Cape Talk, Cape Town's number one news and information station.
Ever since I got my new Kalula.com credit card, I've been doing a lot of traveling. Because when you spend on your Kalula credit card, you earn free flights 3 times faster than with any other credit card. And you get to travel on any Kalula flight, anytime. So today I'm at a chicken farm somewhere in PE with chicken farmer Dion DeVette. Make him sing, Dion. Shame. It would be a shame to eat these chickens, Head Dion, because they're so talented. But, I mean, I'll take a wing.
Sign up for a card before the end of October, and we'll give you 200 Rand to put towards your next flight. Visit Kalula.com or call 0860-666-524 to apply now. Issued by First Rand Bank Limited, an authorized financial services provider.
I'm looking for this DVD. See, there's 3 prequels, which I've got. And they've released the second sequel, but 2 different versions were released at the same time. And there was a limited edition, and you can tell them apart by the tiny gold seal on the top left-hand corner of the back cover. Do you have that one?
Fans aren't easy to please.
Well, not for our competitors.
But with the widest range of DVD titles available, no matter what you're looking for, we've got it. If not, we'll get it. Look and listen for the fans.
Don't miss Graham Hopkins playing the world's most famous tourist, Phineas Fogg, in Jules Verne's Around the World in 80 Days, a madcap high-speed romp of theatrical ingenuity. Hi, I'm Peter Turing, inviting you on the journey of a lifetime of five wonderful actors in Around the World in 80 Days, a comedy now on at our Theatre on the Bay. Book your tickets at the theatre or a CompuTicket.
In the last 24 hours, what's happened in your world?
Comair says it takes passenger safety very seriously, and that's why a Kalula flight was turned back to Cape Town. The plane left another city just after 11 for Johannesburg. A short while later, the pilot turned back following threats made by two passengers.
The full-on investigation is being done by the National Police into what exactly happened. During a press meeting at AXA's offices, the general manager could not give any information except that threats were made on board.
24 hours a day. Eyewitness News. As it happens, when it happens. From Cape Town's number one news and information station. 567 Cape Talk. 567.
567 Cape Town's number one news and information station. Call Believe It or Not on 021 446 0567.
Welcome back, Professor Richard Dawkins. We're talking about his new book published by Bantam. Get one quickly because it's going to walk off the shelves, called The God Delusion. Another very representative SMS, Richard, is, please ask the prof, what would be the reason for having good morals and ethics at all if we only have this one life? What's the purpose of this one life then? That's a pretty representative SMS that's coming in.
Yes. If the implication is that the only reason we are good is that we have another life and we hope to be rewarded in the next life, then I think that's a rather ignoble reason for being good. Or we're frightened of going to hell. That would be a very bad reason for being good as well. Surely we're not good just because we hope for reward and are frightened of punishment. Surely we are good for better reasons than that. If I thought somebody was good to me only because he wanted a reward or was afraid of a punishment, I would not think that was really good at all. Moral philosophers for centuries have tried to work out principles of good and bad, principles like do to others what you would wish them to do to you. Would you wish to live in a world in which everybody was selfish? Why not try to live the way you wish everybody else would live in order to make the world a better place? Feel empathy, feel sympathy. We give money to charity, we give money to the poor, we give money to animal charities. We feel sympathetic towards other people or other living creatures. We feel their pain. We cry with them. These are all human virtues. They have nothing to do with the fact, with whether or not it's the fact that we have another life. They are virtues which should uplift us in this, the only life we've got.
And the second part of that comment, the meaning of life then?
Well, the meaning of life is can be interpreted in different ways. If you mean, from a biological point of view, what's the meaning of life? What is life here for? Why is there life on Earth? What is the biological rationale for each living creature? The answer to that, I'm afraid, is simply to reproduce and pass on one's genes. But that's not my meaning of life. My meaning of life is, I hope, rather better than that. It's partly to have a good time. It's partly to help other people to have a good time. It's partly to try to make the world a better place. There are all sorts of meanings that one can give to life. We have aims and desires. We want to finish the book we're writing. We want to finish the model aeroplane we're making. We want to win a game of football. There are all sorts of purposes, long-term or short-term, grand or more mundane, which we all of us have, and those all give meaning to life. Love of family, love of wife or husband and children, these all give meaning to life. But that's a different kind of meaning from the scientific meaning that I was talking about previously.
So we don't need God?
Well, I don't think we need God. If there are people who have a psychological need for God, then that may be, but the mere fact that you've got a need for something doesn't mean that it exists. Somebody can say, oh, I desperately need God, but I can say, well, I'm sorry, but you may need God, but that won't make him exist.
I've an SMS here from Manu Padachi. He says, gods die. Does anyone worship the Greek, Egyptian or Norse gods now?
That's an excellent point. There are lots and lots of gods. Apollo and Zeus, Wotan and Thor, Baal and Mithras and Amun-Ra. Hundreds and hundreds of gods. Nobody worships them anymore. One day, I hope, the God of the Old and the New Testament will go the same way.
Also, SMS is coming in about people who claim they can communicate with the other side. Your take on that?
Well, the human brain is a remarkably effective and efficient imaginer and hallucinator. There are all sorts of things that we imagine. Every night when we go to sleep, we dream. And our mind is populated by strange and wonderful things that we perhaps never seen, or people who were once dead come alive again. All sorts of things are conjured up by our mind. And if they can conjure them up when we're asleep, there's no reason why they shouldn't conjure them up when we're awake as well. So if you think you hear a still, small voice in your head, or if you think you can imagine that God is talking to you through your feelings, well, I'm afraid there's no reason to suppose that that's anything other than a fertile imagination.
I've got Ed on the line from Cape Town. Hi, Ed.
Hello. How did you guess?
Okay.
Yes, oh, thanks. That's very interesting to hear Richard Dawkins speak. I'm very glad to hear it. I just did have a question. I'm not... there's one argument that the God folk always present, which I found a little troubling, and I thought Richard's argument against it seemed so complex. I wonder if he could simplify it. It's the argument that, oh, the dimensions of the universe seem to be so perfect, they seem to be so exactly suited to life on planet Earth. There's this extraordinary amount of statistical evidence suggesting that how could it possibly, the argument, mm-hmm. but I'd like to hear your response to that argument.
It's a very interesting argument. If you take the fundamental constants of physics, about half a dozen numbers, which physicists have no rationale for, they just seem to be numbers and they're just fixed. If they were the tiniest bit different, then the universe wouldn't be the sort of universe we know. It would be a very different kind of universe, and life almost certainly would not have arisen. Which has led some people to say those fundamental constants have been fine-tuned in such a way as to make life probable, as to make the evolution of life happen. It's as though there were six divine knobs to twiddle, and God, since some of these people believe in God, God has twiddled those knobs to exactly the right value in order to give rise to life. Now, that, as you can see, is not an explanation for anything, because since what we're trying to explain is the improbability of these six knobs being in exactly the right position, these six numbers having exactly the right value, not a bit too large and not a bit too small, if we are then going to invoke a God to fine-tune them, we're still left with the need to explain the God. And the God has got to be every bit of improbable, if not more so, than the fine-tuned numbers themselves. So you haven't explained anything. Now, it may be, and some physicists believe this, that it'll eventually turn out that when physics has gone a bit further, they'll discover that these six numbers are not actually independent. The knobs couldn't be twiddled at all. They are simply the only way that they could be. Now, that's a view that's taken by some physicists, such as, I think, the Nobel Prize-winning physicist Steven Weinberg. Another view, which is gaining ground among physicists, is that the universe that we inhabit is only one of many billions of universes. There's a kind of foam. It's like a foam of soap bubbles. And each bubble is a universe. We are in one of those bubbles. Neighboring bubbles have different values of the fundamental constants and the laws of physics. Now, in a universe, in a multiverse, rather, of billions of universes, the majority of those universes, according to this theory, have the wrong values of those constants. But, of course, those universes that have the wrong values won't have any life. That's what we've just agreed. We are bound to be sitting in one of that minority of universes that has the right values of those half-dozen constants. This is called the anthropic principle. Because we exist, we have to be in the kind of universe that's capable of giving rise to us. The laws of physics that we know are actually bylaws. Bylaws of a parochial little local universe which is sitting in a much larger multiverse of other universes. So there are really three theories to account for the fine-tuning. One is the God theory, which, as I say, is no explanation because it leaves unanswered the question of how God came into existence. The second is the sophisticated Steven Weinberg-type physicist theory that the numbers were not free to vary anyway. And the third is the multiverse theory that says there are lots of universes and we have to be sitting in one of the minority that has the right values of those constants.
Well, thank you. We have to leave it there. We were talking to Professor Richard Dawkins about his book, The God Delusion. Thank you very much, Prof. Dawkins, for talking to it. It's a hugely controversial anti-religion polemic in which he attacks the dubious morality offered by Holy Scriptures and shows how religion fuels war, foments bigotry, abuses children. Well, you heard what Prof. Dawkins has to say, and he concludes that atheism is not a recipe for despair, because if you disclaim the possibility of a next life and don't see this one as something to be endured before eternal bliss or damnation, well, that's life-affirming in a way religion can never be. Thank you to Kiso Lafifi, thanks to Tumi Morobi, and thanks to all of you for being part of Believe It or Not. Good night.